So there's been a lot of excitement in the world of stem cell research over the past few years. Scientists have figured out ways to reprogram adult stem cells so that they behave like embryonic cells. The FDA earlier this year approved the first clinical trial of a stem cell-derived treatment. But some of the biggest news has been in stem cell policy, which is dramatically different under the Obama administration than it was during the Bush administration. And there's now a shift in the rules for federal funding of stem cell research. I'm Andrew Plemons Pratt, Managing Editor at Science Progress, and welcome to the latest installment of our podcast series. Joining me today to talk about the current state of stem cell research and how things may change under the Obama administration's new rules is Kurt Sivan, who is the founding director of the Center for Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and Bernard Siegel, who is the executive director of the Genetics Policy Institute. Both of them are co-chairs of the upcoming World Stem Cell Summit that will take place in Baltimore, Maryland in September. Thank you to Bernie Siegel and Kurt Sivan for joining us to talk about stem cell research and policy today.
Glad to be here. This should be fun.
Well, I want to start off by asking a question that I think is on the minds of a lot of people who are working either in the research side or the policy side of stem cell research, which is, how have the new NIH guidelines for human embryonic stem cell research funding changed things for researchers?
Okay, so I'm a stem cell researcher, and let me tell you two stories.
Sure.
The first story is pre-guidelines, one of the problems we had. So my research group is about 15 people, and it consists of faculty members and lab technicians, but also trainees are very important, and they're the majority of the members. They'll be postdoctoral trainees who have already gotten their PhDs or MDs or both, and predoctoral trainees, students. So these students and other trainees and faculty members, you know, part of the thing we do in science is our thoughts are open at our lab meetings. We discuss, we certainly don't keep secrets from each other, and we try to help each other and interact. Many of the discoveries we make together and standing on each other's shoulders, as well as with other colleagues nearby. But let me just tell you the story in microcosm in my lab meeting. So we're sitting there, and some of our research funding comes from the state of Maryland, and Maryland has been generous and forward-looking in terms of supporting stem cell research beyond the President Bush guidelines. So in that research, we could use human embryonic stem cells that weren't on the prior NIH list. But somebody says, okay, what if we, those of us who are working with this Maryland funding, what if we're, part of our support comes from a U.S. government NIH training grant? That means we can't work on our project. And our money to support our salary only supports our salary, not our project money. Our project money only supports our research, not our salary money. And I said, okay, can't do that.
Sort of a divided loyalty between your salary and what you actually want to work on.
Well, divided rules, you know, and this would be misuse of federal funds. So that's fine. Half the lab we paint red and people, and half the lab we paint blue and all the culture media bottles and everything. We make sure we, for the right cells, we use red media or blue media. But what about when somebody in the lab meeting is doing some work with human embryonic stem cell lines that are beyond the President Bush guidelines and makes an important discovery, needs to take it to the next stage, and usually in the lab meeting somebody will say, "Ooh, I can help you do that," or "I know just the technology," or "I have an idea to do that." The usual response is, "Well, let's work together and get that done." And then somebody says, "But oh no, I'm supported on U.S. federal monies. I can't do that." Could you do it and not be an author? No. So this constrained our natural interactions. In Maryland, it also constrained our interactions with colleagues at the National Institutes of Health. That's a big research center, less than an hour away in Maryland. And so it really, this sort of thing slowed us down. We lived in fear and uncertainty about that, and as you know, that's a bad place to live. So that's story one. That period is over.
No, that's it. I've heard similar stories about labs having to keep two sets of all of their tools, like you were explaining, two sets of refrigerators. But this seems to sort of go beyond that. It really was breaking down the usual ways that you would want to teach graduate students how to do science.
Yeah, the free and open interaction. I guess the second part of the story is, what if somebody working with the blue cell lines, as it were, that were outside the President Bush guidelines, made an important discovery. We study blood formation and cancer formation from stem cells, and made an important discovery about how this happened, or with cancer more important, how to interrupt the process. And the natural thing would be to try to repeat that experiment with another person, either in the lab or outside the lab. But what if that person doesn't have funding that allows the person to do it? You know, where does it go? How could you, you know, we often use the Maryland monies and philanthropic monies, which are less restricted, and also there's less of it, less money, to do pilot projects that, when they land, we try to get larger, longer NIH grants to support the opening up of that discovery and maybe even translating it to clinical action. How would we do it? How would others repeat our work? How would we repeat the work of others? This corrupts the scientific process of extending and verifying people's work by first repeating it exactly in different hands, and then repeating it with different tools and reagents. How is this going to happen again? We're free of that quandary now, and this, so we can just think about the hard thing about curing these many diseases that can be helped by stem cells.
Sure. Well, that's heartening to hear that you can sort of get back to doing science the way that that you're used to and the way that you want to train future researchers. Bernie, can I maybe turn to you and hear a little bit about what's new in the advocacy and the policy world now that these guidelines hit the ground?
Well, of course, the political climate for embryonic stem cell research changed for the better with the new administration. And looking back, President Bush, when he pronounced his policy on August 9, 2001, not only did he limit the stem cell line for which NIH could fund research to about the 21 lines that were in existence on that time and date and no further. But he also took off the table NIH developing comprehensive guidelines. So what we found is almost every funding entity and states came into play, such as Maryland, such as Connecticut and California. Organizations like Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation and private philanthropy, many of these, if not all of them, had their own regulations related to this research going forward. And with NIH off the stage, it was like the orchestra conductor just about to start the symphony dropped the baton and went off the stage. And everyone is playing to their own tune. So the big change, of course, is now NIH has developed guidelines. And, of course, the advocacy community is delighted because it gives the prospect of going way beyond the 21 lines that were eligible, so-called presidential lines, back in 2001, to the many, many additional lines developed around the world to be eligible for funding. And some of these lines, of course, if not most of them, were created with more modern techniques, meaning that some of them created without animal proteins and such. So these will be very valuable to researchers. So the big picture is, things are much, much better than they were. But however, there are still issues that remain for the advocacy community. The current guidelines did not address downstream research for such things as somatic cell nuclear transfer, the so-called therapeutic cloning, which scientists want to study as for disease modeling. By not addressing these things, we certainly, as an advocacy community, want to see legislation come forward, not only to codify these new guidelines, which is very important. It shouldn't be just by an executive order, but also to go more far-reaching into things like somatic cell nuclear transfer that have been long controversial, but we have to understand there's a difference between cloning cells and cloning people.
You talked a little bit for a moment there about the number of lines that were available under the previous administration guidelines, and there's a recent letter that appeared actually in Nature Biotechnology. I don't know if either of you have had the chance to peruse this, about the number of lines that were available through the primary stem cell bank that was hosted at the University of Wisconsin. There were 21 lines available under those rules, but it turns out that actually there's not a huge amount of diversity in the number of lines that were actually getting requested in order for people to do federally funded work on them. Is this a concern that you see the new guidelines addressing, getting some more diversity into the number of lines that people have access to? And is that something important in terms of doing good science?
Let me try to put that in perspective.
Sure.
With mouse embryonic stem cells, it's been estimated that no more than 50 mouse embryonic stem cell lines have been made. And we've actually found a couple that work really well, and almost everybody uses those couple.
And 50 lines over how many years?
20.
20 years, wow.
So now the mouse work and the work that will be and is being done in human is different. But I'm trying to say we don't need millions and millions of lines unless we can easily, cheaply, and effectively make stem cells for everyone, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But for the science piece of it, at least, we don't need huge numbers of lines. But then this gets to a difference between the human and the mouse lines. Most of those 50 lines that were made function really well. They grow really well. They're good. They're outstanding research tools. None of the existing human embryonic stem cell lines, including the 21, President Bush list lines, and the larger list that will presumably be on the so-called President Obama list, none of these are optimal lines yet.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to test more widely lines and make new lines in order to find a few good ones. Now, these good ones won't be good forever. Any cell lines that are, expanded up, handed out to lots of investigators and kept in culture will undergo mutations and things like that. So there'll need to be some replacement. But this isn't massive scale, particularly once we find a few good lines. So these lines are there are scientific and technological problems with working with human embryonic stem cells, even if you take out all the political problems.
Mm-hmm.
So taking out the political problems, frees our minds and makes politics easier and makes things potentially possible. But science is difficult. And so we are at the difficult stage, and we're trying again to stand on each other's shoulders of saying, okay, so-and-so had a good experience using this cell line. I'll try that. And then you start working with that for a while. And, numerous people who start using human embryonic stem cells stop because it's so difficult, and they just haven't gotten any productivity in that time. So in order to harvest this tool, there really needs to be a lot of concentration on the technology. And this goes for the new induced pluripotent stem cells also, that they are difficult to work with and get them to do what they need to do your experiments in science or your hope for future transplantation. They're just difficult experiments, and it will take a while. We've got to have patience with us. It's not just throwing cell lines at the problem.
Well, that's helpful to understand. This isn't just about the availability of cell lines. Bernie, are there other factors that you see coming into play besides just policy adjustments, increased access to federal funding, that are really going to help grow this field, maybe coming from the philanthropic sector, the private sector? What's gonna help get this field growing again at the pace that people want to see it?
Well, you can't underestimate the difficulty and challenges as the result of a paucity of funding on fundamental human embryonic stem cell research for the last 8 years. It has been a problem. This is a huge potential for discovering the root causes of disease, to be used as a tool for drug discovery, and one day perhaps launching to an era of robust cell therapy. Now, what is important is that we are beyond just looking at embryonic stem cells. This is a part of a whole field of regenerative medicine, which includes dealing with iPS cells, adult cells, tissue engineering, and we kind of are opening our eyes to a new era. We see many, many new companies coming into play with cell therapies in mind. Indeed, it's perhaps a whole new regenerative medicine industry, a nascent industry, which is an offshoot of the biotechnology industry that is now out there. And they are concerned with issues of how clinicians are going to be trained to do cell therapies, how are reimbursements going to be considered, who is going to invent the devices, what are the intellectual property issues, and a myriad of other issues for this new industry to get underway. And I think the stem cell advocacy community has to take a broader look at this now. This isn't just a remnant of the culture wars that really held back this research in the United States. I think we are getting beyond that, and we have to look at this as an advocacy community that wants to move this whole field forward sooner rather than later. There should be a major federal initiative to put together all of the agencies of federal government that are funding regenerative medicine, whether it's the Department of Defense, whether it's NIST, part of the Department of Commerce, to determine the standards that are necessary to advance this, the NIH, and to build a collaborative federal effort to fund this properly and to move it forward, not unlike what was done by the federal government with the semiconductor industry in the 1980s and 90s, and with really federal attention to this in a big way. This is a potential for game-changing technology that can really go beyond anything that we have, possibly leading one day to major health benefits and replacing damaged tissues and organs. It is a game changer. Of course, FDA is coming into play, too, as we see the very first clinical trial, safety trial, with human embryonic stem cells now, the Geron trial.
Let me second two points that Bernie made. The first point about putting our money where our mouths are. In terms of the salutary changes in the guidelines that President Obama instituted to expand the guidelines, this is awesome. This is necessary, and this has been the result of a victory in the culture wars, as it were, for me. On the other hand, if it's changes in guidelines need to be coupled with increases in the financial resources for stem cell research and Bernie makes that point powerfully, that we have to put our money now, that these limitations are taken away.
Well, how about the extra $10 billion that got added to the NIH budget over the course of the next 2 years? Is that going to be a sufficient kickstart to fund additional stem cell work?
I would venture to say, surprisingly, not. That funding might go to benefit some of the existing research and moving it forward. But that's funding, I understand, that has to move out the door quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, with the establishment of the new guidelines, means that we need to study the ethical basis, the provenance of all the existing guidelines fresh, including the Bush line. So we'll actually probably find less funding this year for human embryonic stem cell research than the previous year, just because we're going through this new evaluation process. So that $10 billion might not have the impact that we would all like, even though it's very important to fund basic research. I don't think it's going to be going primarily, certainly, to human embryonic stem cell research at all.
Right.
Bernie's right. The guidelines kind of have changed, but it hasn't been activated. We don't have the new list of the new President Obama-approved cell lines, and that will probably take a month to a year or two to get fully generated. We know that it's going to come. We're encouraged, but we don't know what it will be.
Well, and there'll have to be each line that may need to get review, particularly for in the informed consent that led up to its derivation, will sort of have to be reviewed again on a piece-by-piece basis, correct?
One of the ironies is that it's conceivable, at least it's a worry, that, say, one of the most used, I'm not picking on a particular cell line, but in theory, it could happen that one of the most used President Bush approved cell lines, somebody doesn't like something in the informed consent document. And, ooh, now, how can somebody repeat that research?
We hate to go back to the drawing board on so many aspects of this. And to harken back on the other point that I was making, we have different states with different guidelines.
Mm-hmm.
California is a huge funder now of human embryonic stem cell research. That they may choose to fund lines that the federal government finally decides are off limits to NIH funding. And Kurt raised the problems that happened over the past few years in his own lab in Maryland, the concern. So we're not necessarily through the woods yet, even though the climate certainly has changed. We have a lot of work to do and a lot of heavy lifting to bring this all to fruition.
Well, you mentioned the what may remain is a patchwork of state-level rules. Do you see any continuing contention over funding or access to or the legality of stem cell research moving from a federal level to a state-by-state level where people duke it out and say, we want this or we don't want this in our state? Is that the direction you see this discussion going?
I think from an advocacy perspective, that is really a concern.
Mm-hmm.
We still have brutal state-by-state fights. The foes of embryonic stem cell research did not disappear.
Mm-hmm.
And in almost every state, you will see bills filed to curb embryonic stem cell research. These are not well publicized, but every once in a while, the legal battles, the political battles erupt in a way that there are actually ballot initiatives, as there were a few years ago in Missouri and most recently in the last election cycle in Michigan, where we find now embryonic stem cell research protected in the state constitutions, arguably a fundamental right, which is part of this broad, what we call a pro-cures movement of consumers that feel that this is a personal health issue, and that's part of what's driving this all forward. So we still have these state-by-state fights, and on an even larger perspective, we still have different funding regimes and different rules and regulations. And hopefully now with the federal government and NIH taking its historical role as the conductor, of the symphony, we'll get more and more of these states and these funders on the same wavelength. And it's not only funding research in the United States, it's also funding research in abroad and being able to use the fruits of international researchers and laboratories in the United States. So, again, it's going to take a lot of regulatory heavy lifting.
It's interesting in that the opponents of stem cell research have a new argument in these times of economic trouble. And so in the states which have been generous in their support of stem cell research,
based on their philosophy and the perceived gains to their interests and gains of their state. Now, these opponents of stem cell research are saying, hey, we don't have money. Let's cut this.
And on the other hand, the folks that have and states that have funded this very often, and I would argue rightfully, perceive that this is an area ripe for economic development, that this is the diamond point of innovation in a biotechnology industry, and that will lead to jobs. It will lead to robust growth in the state. And those states that have adopted a liberal regime to promote this are going to benefit, and certain states that have, you know, put curbs on the research are unlikely to be at least the initial beneficiaries of this.
In fact, in Maryland, we argue that in many ways research is the business. Research not only leads to business development, but research is the business. So many Marylanders are engaged in scientific research and early corporate biotechnology research in Montgomery County, scientific research at NIH, at Johns Hopkins, at the University of Maryland campuses, that it is a very, very big driver of jobs and the economy in Maryland, so that we argue that it makes sense for our state to continue to invest so that its researchers can leverage that investment into increased federal grants as well as biotechnology jobs.
And indeed, that was a similar argument that helped the ballot initiative in Michigan open up access for stem cell research because of the economic impact that the biotech industry had. So it seems compelling in spite of the fact that we are in a recession and a lot of states are having to cut budgets and cut corners. Well, we referenced a couple of times one of the hottest issues, particularly from a media perspective within stem cell research over the past year or two, which is induced pluripotent cells. Can we talk a little bit about the incredible speed with which this particular technology has come about and ask, are there still other routes to pluripotency or stem cell-like cells that we need to pay attention to?
Well, to answer the second question first, scientists don't like to close doors.
Mm-hmm.
So particularly when we get an exciting new technology, you know, I can make a simple analogy of the CAT scan. We got the CAT scan. We were very excited. Could there ever be anything better? Well, then came along the MRI. Ooh, the MRI, and you don't have to have any dangerous radiation. Will the MRI replace the CAT scan? No, we have both today. And in fact, we have combinations of both scans. They each have their unique uses. And sometimes you do one because it's faster or cheaper. In any case, scientists like physicians like to have flexibility. The iPS cells are a two-year-old discovery. We're still learning what they're good for. We're very excited about them. We want to know exactly how optimally to make them, what genes to turn on to make them, what simple treatments we can do to make them without gene insertion and the dangers of gene insertion. For therapy, the initially made iPS cells would certainly not be serious contenders because they contain cancer oncogenes, cancer genes. So really, they're a big, exciting step, but we need to understand lots more about them. The current human embryonic stem cells are the gold standards that we want to compare them to in humans and in other species to learn more about them. That said, we're very excited about them. And they're the past 2 years, you know, they're the big discoveries in the field, if I had to pick one discovery over that period. But what will be next year's discovery? And are there other roads to make stem cells? Certainly there are. And don't forget, of course, embryonic stem cells or adult stem cells. Remember that we do almost 50,000 blood-forming stem cell transplants called bone marrow transplants a year.
What are the next steps along the way to clinical trials for stem cell-derived therapies. There was a trial that was approved earlier this year by the FDA. But I guess the question is, when are we going to sort of move beyond the basic science phase to seeing the application in treatments and potentially cures? And what can we predict at this moment? What sort of ailments or diseases we might target first?
Let me say first on that people, when they think about stem cells, they immediately leap to the icon of stem cell therapies, which is transplanting the stem cells themselves to treat disease. Remember that certain diseases, like diabetes, if you do the transplant of new pancreas cells into somebody with diabetes, well, diabetes usually develops as an immune rejection of the pancreas, and that immunity is still there, and so those cells will likely be rejected again. We need to be, in that case, we need to do more to cure the disease than simply provide the cells. Secondly, in studying blood-forming stem cells and mouse embryonic stem cells, we've made great scientific advances that in the research lab studies of these cells, we've learned how development occurs and how, in some cases, for example, cancer occurs, and in some other cases, other diseases occur. When we've learned the molecular footprints and hallmarks of those diseases, the things that have to go wrong for those diseases to happen, we can then, for example, develop new targeted cancer drugs. And these cancer drugs can be a lot safer and cheaper. They can be whole world therapies instead of the probably restricted to the first world therapies, if we're still a first world country, that transplantation therapies may always be. So what I'm saying is that it isn't only transplantation of stem cells. I'm an enthusiast for that, that validates stem cell research. But it's also the discoveries that will lead to medicines and preventions, so-called whole-world therapies that stem cell research will provide.
I think that's really useful because I think you're right. A lot of discussion of stem cells just makes it sound like the only way to use them is for those transplant therapies. But there's a whole world of other important things that scientists can understand through working with them.
If I could underscore that,
yeah.
Pharmaceutical companies now are showing an increasing interest in stem cells and embryonic stem cell research, and in fact are making investments in the field. Now, why are they doing that? It's because they see these cells as being very stable and as tools for drug discovery. And if they are tools for drug discovery, it might harken to a day when it will be less expensive to produce drugs, or they will be more targeted drugs. So there's a whole side benefit well beyond just beyond cell therapies to this.
There's another interesting story. You probably saw that. I read that General Electric Company just paid $1 gazillion to a biotech company to be able to use stem cells for drug development. I believe they're, if I recall correctly, they're also using that to test toxicity and toxins. This sparks a thought. I'm a physician and a pediatrician, and as a pediatrician, I often bemoan the fact that drugs aren't tested in children, sometimes ever, and there are perfectly good drugs sitting out there that have been tested in adults that may work better in children that never even get to testing, and drugs aren't tested in pregnant women, sometimes ever. And in our clinical trials, we do pregnancy tests on women and don't allow women who are pregnant to be entered on clinical trials because of the potential dangers of an unknown drug. We, of course, test in animal species and test to see if the drug crosses the placenta in animals and in opportunities we can. But what if we instead had a set of model systems where we could look at kidney development from a human embryonic stem cell or an iPS cell, brain development, every organ development, and could say that this drug is obviously toxic here in human cells as well as in animal cells, or this drug isn't, we might have much more confidence in using it early for somebody who has a medical condition that needs to be treated yet is pregnant.
And
for toxicology studies, if we live on the Chesapeake Bay.
Mm-hmm. And given some of the recent concerns over big blockbuster drugs that have had to be pulled off the market because they weren't necessarily as safe as people thought, this sort of pre-market testing applications sounds like a very compelling argument for continuing with this kind of work.
Animal testing only tells you so much.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let me close with a question. Some critics may argue and have argued for quite some time that stem cell research has been overhyped. That promises made haven't come through and will never actually come through, and therefore we ought not to follow through on this kind of research. How do you respond to people who raise that kind of argument?
Well, sometimes the people that are raising that argument are the same that have argued to hold back research funds for this research to advance. This is from the many scientists that I've worked with and had conversations with, almost to every single one of them have said that this is essentially game-changing technology, and today with the information age and the sequencing of the human genome, this stem cell research offers the greatest hope to actually find eventual treatments and cures. The thing is that where it could get overhyped is understanding the time it takes to bring treatments to the market. And the challenge is, especially when we're talking about cell therapy, to get regulatory approval and move this forward. It's really going to take a concentrated effort to move this forward swiftly. I could see the day when we cure a diabetes in a mouse, but it takes 20 years to come to human beings because of regulatory issues, business issues, intellectual property issues. We were relying on a system, the business system of and entrepreneurs, and to come up with businesses to deliver the goods for us. So I don't think the potential of this research has been overhyped. I think that the public has to understand the amount of effort and that it takes on all sides, from the government, from the science, from the business community, to actually pull it together to deliver effective treatments and potential cures. And of course, a big part of that is the regulatory process itself.
I'm a physician, and so I do have to counsel patients who read something in the newspaper or something, and I have to quickly say that this is probably the thing you read about, I'm going to read about, but this is probably a long way from use in a patient. We'll get back to you on this and have to get back, and when I read it, I say, my gosh, I wish they'd said this a different way and curbed their enthusiasm a little. On the other hand, enthusiasm in tackling hard problems is necessary. And I would rather have my patients see a whole bunch of enthusiastic scientists out there working hard, getting excited, and perhaps sometimes being overly exuberant, but pursuing that dream, and some of them are going to make it. It isn't all going to be drugs where we cure mice but not people of cancer or some other disease. Some of those strike gold, and the hype becomes a reality.
And I might add that on September 21st and 23rd, the World Stem Cell Summit is going to be at the Baltimore Convention Center in Baltimore, Maryland, and you'll see a lot of excited scientists there, as well as business community, medical philanthropies, and patients, all working together, some 1,200 to 1,500 of them, to advance this whole field of regenerative medicine. And that's an event that we hope some of your listeners might be interested in, and they can find out more information at worldstemcellsummit.com.
Well, gentlemen, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk about these issues. Kurt Siven is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Maryland School of Medicine and is the director of the Center for Stem Cell Biology and Regenerative Medicine. And Bernard Siegel is the executive director of the Genetics Policy Institute, and they're both co-chairs of the World Stem Cell Summit. Bernie and Kurt, thank you very much for taking the time.
Pleasure.
Thank you.